This presentation is brought to you by iawaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Does anybody know what Valentine's Day is?
It's about a saint.
It's about a saint. So what's it got to do with roses and red hearts? And
it's all commercialized.
St. Hallmark.
Hallmark. Yeah.
I would think from a halachic point of view, if a Jew wanted to celebrate Christmas, it wouldn't be too good. But if he celebrated Valentine's Day, it would be horrific.
Horrific?
Horrific. It is about the most pagan festival that has ever existed. It's unbelievably pagan in its origin. It was even too pagan for the early Christians to tolerate. And thanks to some research by Alan and Liz Danziger, I was able to find out a little bit about it and to realize that while people view it as sort of quite harmless and quaint, its origins and its background aren't that at all. It goes back, it's one of the oldest celebrations, it's one of the oldest non-Jewish Yom Tovs. And it goes back to thousands of years. And it used to be called Lupercalia. And it used to be celebrated on the 15th of February, not on the 14th of February. And it was a day of celebration of two ancient gods, a god and a goddess. That's where the romantic thing comes in. Juno was the goddess of women and of marriage, and Pan was the god of nature, and they used to play around on February the 15th. And there were horrible sacrifices. They used to sacrifice goats and dogs, and there was blood all over the place. This wasn't a nice day. They didn't used to do nice things. And interestingly, as the Christian religion became more significant and more powerful, it began not to question and challenge these pagan practices, but to try and kind of redirect them. And we see Christianity doing that a lot with Judaism, lahavdil. So move Shabbos to Sunday. Don't make a new day with new meaning. This idea of a day of rest that you have in the Old Testament, it's quite a good idea. Let's hijack it. But if we keep it on Shabbos, it's a Jewish day of rest. So let's make it Sunday. The 25th of Kislev, Hanukkah, day of lights, make it the 25th of December. The imitation, when one looks at it, is quite humorous. The getting the free ride on the back of other religions, rather than actually originating something new, is quite interesting. And they took that day of Lupercalia on the 15th, and they moved it to the 14th. Like they moved Shabbos to Sunday, they moved that to the 14th. They called it Valentine's Day. This was in the 5th century, a long time ago, after a Saint Valentine who was killed by the Catholic Church. And that had nothing to do with love or with romance. They were trying to get it away from a love day. They were trying to get it away from the pagan stuff. So for the last 1500 years, the Christian Church has been trying to make it a non-romantic day. A day to celebrate. It's a Yahrzeit. This is a Yahrzeit. This is not a day of fun and pleasure. This is a day of commemoration. This is like Tzom Gedalia Lahavdil. Somebody was murdered. Somebody was killed. This is a day. It should be a day of fasting. One sees how chaotic the non-Jewish celebrations are. People don't know what they are and the mixture of emotions. So to take something which is to commemorate the murder of a person they consider to be saintly, and to turn it into this romantic day, which is what it used to be when it was pagan on the 15th in another religion, and mix all that together in one day and call it St. Valentine's Day on the 14th, but celebrate the love of the 15th and push it all together and mix it up. Very, very messy. One of the things that the Jewish religion teaches is that a blintzer can be delicious and a steak can be delicious. But when you put a blintzer and a steak together, it's treif. And that's something that Western culture is struggling with somewhat again. That two good things put together don't make an even better thing. Sometimes they make something worse than either. And so you'll find many secular Jews, many assimilated Jews, who'll say, Hanukkah is good and Christmas is nice. So let's celebrate them both. What's the big deal? The children will grow up with the richness of two cultures. It's like growing up with the Milchiks and the Fleishiks. You get the treif. There are certain things that you don't mix, and in many other religions and in many other practices, and certainly in secular life, there's an enormous mixing of differences. We have milk and meat, we have chutneys, linen and wool, we have certain things that we don't, the laws of grafting. There is a certain discipline that the Torah teaches in certain places, that not everything that is good separate becomes good together. In relationships, by the way, you can have a nice man and a nice woman, and they get together and make a horrible marriage. You can have a horrible man and a horrible woman who get together and make a very nice marriage. That's also possible. The blend is not always the sum total of the parts. The blend is often very different to the parts. And that's perhaps what makes the whole area of relationships a difficult area, and an area in which we're not doing too well. The signs of us not doing too well are the proliferation of older singles, homosexuals, I'm not putting them in anywhere near the same category, and divorced people. If you look at the failed marriages, non-marriages, and anti-marriages, the numbers are horrendous. And one must question what's happened to relationships. What's going wrong? And we can't say it was always like this. It wasn't always like this. And we can't say that it's getting better. It's getting worse. And we can't say that any particular community is free from it. We can say it's worse in some communities, less serious in other communities. My brother-in-law, who's visiting here at the moment from Monson, New York, is very involved in helping religious teenagers in difficulties and various different difficulties and problems. And I said to him, are you coming across much homosexuality among the religious community? He said, hardly any, very little. Coming across other very serious problems, but not that. Hardly, you get it here and there, but it's not, by no means an epidemic. And I asked him why he thought that was. And he gave a very interesting answer, and I haven't thought it through yet to figure out if I agree with it or not, but a very interesting answer. He said in the among Jewish young people, the forbidden waters is a heterosexual relationship. So to really get out there and experiment and try something new is to get a girl and to build a relationship with a girl. That's something that was not allowed. It's not allowed pre-marriage, wasn't allowed while they were in school, while they were growing up. So the whole idea of getting into a new area that has previously not been open to them, the focus is on a heterosexual relationship. But in secular society, they had girls when they were 12 and 13. So what's left when they're 15 and 16? What are they going to try? What area are they going to experiment and explore? Now, I don't know if that's anywhere near the whole reason, and of course there are many complex aspects of it, but whether or not homosexuality is a problem in religious society or isn't, there isn't a society that is free from the deteriorating qualities of heterosexual relationships, and in all those areas of failed marriages, of singles, and homosexuality is a rise that must make us question what is going on. And one would expect, if there is such a day as Valentine's Day, that from a society point of view, from a societal point of view, rather than from individuals, what society should be doing is in fact questioning that. What is it all about? What is going on? Why so many difficulties? What are the problems? And part of the problems are exactly that, the Milchik and Fleishik problem. The assumption that a good blintzer and a good piece of steak will make a good dish. And not realizing that that's not necessarily so at all. Trying to find perfection in the other person. Not realizing that if the other person were perfect, you're the last one they would want. And that's difficulty, but that's difficult because we live in a society that seeks perfection in objects. We collect perfect objects, we produce perfect objects, we strive for perfection in objective things. Something out there needs to be perfect. And so we want our houses to look perfect, and we want our clothes to be perfect, and we want our hi-fi sets to work perfectly, and we want our cars to go perfectly, and we want our computer programs to go perfectly. We're constantly involved in trying to achieve perfection in something outside there. And there's not really much of an emphasis on how perfect am I? To what degree am I perfecting myself? And when there is any kind of effort at self-perfection, it's on the object of the self rather than the subject of the self. It's the body, it's the muscles, it's the image, it's the skin. And the skin's about as deep as it goes. That's about as far as it goes. When the perfection is in any way self-directed, we must understand that even in the self there is a subject and an object. My body is my object. That's not me. That expresses me. That's a tool I use. It's an instrument I use. And to strive for physical perfection in the body is no different than striving for perfection in the things around me, in my environment, in the machines that I use, in the house that I live in. But perfection in the self is something that there's very little focus on. Because perfection in the self is not attainable, and we don't like to deal with challenges that are not really attainable. The idea of improvement is just not good enough for us. We like achieving. We like making it. We like getting there. We like results. And in the area of self-improvement, there are no results. It's a journey. It's a process. And you never get there. And the Western mind finds that hard to deal with and hard to grapple with. And so we get into relationships. And anybody who's had anything to do with trying to put two people together, what's the big obstacle? Who does he think he is that he will only look at girls like this? And who does she think she is that she will only look at men like this? Because we're looking for perfection. I want to marry Mr. Perfect. I want to marry Miss Perfect. And we don't realize that in a relationship what's important is the perfection of the relationship, not the perfection of the two parties. That you can have two very imperfect people that can make a very beautiful relationship. You can have two people who are imperfect in different areas, but their strengths are complementary. And the whole, the total, is something very beautiful and something very worthwhile. But for that, an individual has to be able to feel a relationship. He has to be able to feel what it's like being in that relationship, rather than looking at another person and saying, I like her, or I like him, or I don't. I'm not suggesting that attraction is not an important part of a relationship. Of course it is. Without that, there's nothing. You can't even start without that. There has to be an attractiveness. But there's a big gap between attractiveness and perfection. Now, lots of people who will admit to being attracted to lots of people, but wouldn't consider a serious relationship with them. When it comes to the commitment issue, who's the problem? The man or the woman? So a relationship goes and they go out for 6 months, a year, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, nothing's happening. And eventually it sort of fizzles out or something happens. Start again, 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, well, nothing happens. Where's the nothing happen? Is it the man or the woman generally? Who has the commitment problem generally? How many people say it's the man? Generally, I'm not saying all places, how many people say it's the woman? The majority by far say, the two Rosenfields say it's the woman. Interesting. Dennis, what did you teach your daughters? It's generally the man. And why? Very interesting reason. People sometimes find it difficult to figure out why it's the man. The man has such an easy time. He gets a wife. And she takes care of him, and she cooks for him, and she keeps a home for him, and she creates a family for him. Why would a man have a difficulty with commitment? Men should be lining up. Why should men have a problem with commitment? What do they have to commit to that's such a big deal? The Torah says in Eicha, Tov legever ki yiso ol bin urov. it's good for a man to take on a burden while he's still young. That's the verse. The Gemara says on that, in the Medrash, oh, what's the burden it's talking about? Zerisha. It's a wife. Now, you might look at that and say, but that's very very anti-feminist, and that's very old-fashioned and so on. But we just saw, we took a survey, and we found that most people believe the person finding the problem in commitment is the man. Therefore, let's accept that a woman is a burden to a man. We'll have to figure out why. It doesn't seem to make sense on the surface. But let's not push it out of our minds just because it's politically incorrect to assume that. The assumption is she's there to serve the man. She makes his life beautiful. And there are plenty of Gemaras, I'll show you, that say just that. So why is she a burden? But the fact is men find it difficult to commit. So generally men are scared of something. Men are weary of something. They're worried about something. Says the Gemara, yes, it's an all. This is a yoke. Of course men are worried about a yoke. What is the nature of the yoke? It doesn't make sense. If you look at what a good wife does, and what she gives up, and how she treats a man, why on earth would that be considered a yoke? And we're not talking about feminist wives. We're talking about good old-fashioned wives that took care of their men and enjoyed doing that. Is that a yoke? By the way, by feminist wives, I don't mean accomplished wives. It's a difference. Feminist wives are women on a mission to prove that men are no better than women. That's a feminist wife. I'm not talking about accomplished women, outstanding women. That's not what I mean by a feminist wife. So what is the nature of this all? What does he have to do? He has to support her. He has to earn a living for her. It's more expensive to employ people to do what she does. People who sell life insurance for wives, suddenly discovered men were taking out life insurance. Eventually the market became saturated. The new chap, they came to sell life insurance to the husbands. What would happen if your wife died, God forbid? How much would it cost you to find somebody to do what she does? And people started making the calculations. And believe me, those men who take life insurance out on their wives are in for a payout far in excess of the cost of their wives. So we've got to say that yes, you have to support a wife, but the value is far in excess of the cost of supporting her. So why is it an all? Where's the all? Where's the yoke? Some years ago, John Gray asked that question. And here's the answer. Men are from Mars and women are from Venus. And I never read it before because I thought that's a stupid title and it's wrong. Men aren't from Mars, women aren't. Everybody knows women were made from man's rib. They didn't come from Venus, a different planet. They come from the same place. So I assumed from the title that the thesis was wrong. But in preparing the shir, I figured I'd better just see what he says. It's not wrong. The book is right. Forget the Mars and the Venus. That's not important. The all is, a man has to be prepared to take upon himself the lifelong responsibility of satisfying and making happy a person he has no chance of ever understanding. And that is the all. That's a yoke. That is difficult. And let's look at some of the areas. Let's look at some of the areas that it's difficult for men. And people will recognize them immediately. When women talk about problems, men usually resist. A man assumes she's talking with him about her problems because she is holding him responsible. The more problems, the more he feels blamed. He doesn't realize that she's talking to feel better. A man doesn't know that she will appreciate it if he just listens. Men talk about problems for only two reasons. They're blaming someone or they're seeking advice. If a woman is really upset, a man assumes she's blaming him. If she seems less upset, then he assumes she's asking for advice. So he works through how men respond and how wrong it is, and how the women get quite upset about it. He then goes through some of the language differences. When a woman says, I want to forget everything, translated into men's language, that means, I want you to know that I love my work and my life. But today I'm overwhelmed. I would love to do something really nurturing for myself before I have to be responsible again. Would you ask me what's the matter? And then listen with empathy without offering solutions. I just want to feel your understanding, the pressures I feel. It would make me feel so much better. It would help me to relax. If she says this house is always a mess, translated into men's language, that means, today I feel like relaxing, but the house is messy. I'm frustrated and I need a rest. I hope you won't expect me to clean it up. Nothing is working, translated into men's language, means today I'm overwhelmed and I'm so grateful that I can share my feelings with you. It helps me so much to feel better. You don't love me anymore, means today I'm feeling as though you don't love me. I'm afraid I've pushed you away. I know you really do love me. You do so much for me. Today I'm just feeling a little insecure. So, and in these cases, what she means is the opposite of what she says. That's the all. That you have to live with somebody and constantly translate. Because she will never learn your language and you will never learn his language. Because if you do learn her language or she does learn your language, you will lose interest in each other. So the key to the romance requires that she remains a woman and that you remain a man and that you have this quest to try and understand but never do, because there's this cultural difference that you're living with intimately and need to be able to overcome without actually mastering it. You can never really fully understand it. That's an all. That's a yoke. That's a burden. Not at all. I'll explain that in a moment. Not in the least. When a man loves a woman, so that, on that we disagree, by the way, with John Gray. Dr. Gray says it is the same for the woman. She can't understand men as well. I disagree with that. Women are brilliant at understanding everything about men so quickly. And they know exactly how to handle them. If they'll only use their intuitions, it's men who have the problem, that we have to sympathize with them. Not all men. When a man loves a woman, she begins to shine with love and fulfillment. Most men naively expect that shine to last forever. To expect her loving nature to be constant is like expecting the weather never to change and the sun to shine all the time. We'll touch on to that a little bit further on. But what he does say that's rather important is that a man assumes that a sudden change of mood is based solely on his behavior. When she is happy, he takes credit. When she is unhappy, he feels responsible. He may feel extremely frustrated because he doesn't know how to make things better. One minute she seems happy, so he believes he's doing a good job. And the next minute she's unhappy. He's shocked because he thought he was doing well. Can't figure it out. And so the book goes on. The all is not about anything physical or anything financial. The burden, the yoke that we're talking about is the responsibility, the yoke, the hardship, the challenge of living with somebody who you think you know very well, and on certain levels you think you understand very well, and yet there's always that part of that person that, because you're not a woman, you cannot ever understand. And that doesn't give you license not to take heed of it and not to care for it and not to make, not a question of even making allowances of it, but not to, you can't abandon and say, well, this is another person from another culture, I don't understand them, so I can't be expected to make them happy. Marriage is about making a person happy who you don't really understand. You don't understand what makes them happy, and yet that becomes your responsibility. The other way around? No, the other way around doesn't work like that at all, because women have an intuition, have an ability, and of course we're generalizing, obviously, that. Perfectly correct. You have men who are particularly intuitive and tuned in and do understand women, and you have women who don't understand men at all, obviously. But generally, women have the capacity to understand men very well. That's not their hardship. They have other hardships. But their hardship is not, I'm living with a man that I cannot understand. She can understand him. She can know how to manipulate him in a negative sense necessarily, but certainly how to drive him in different ways. She understands that, she knows that. Occasionally she gets a little confused, but it's not anything as serious as the all of a man. And therefore, the Torah says, Tov legever ki yisrael bin urov. The younger a man starts, the more chance he has, not of learning it, but of being malleable enough to be able to live with it, to be able to function with it, to be able to ride it, to be able to go along with it, and not to feel he's got to understand it, he's got to master it, he's got to analyze it. Just to be able to go along with it and live with it and feel it in a way that that he can and can enjoy it and celebrate it. And what I'm going to do with you with the time that we have left is just scan through a few statements from the Gemara and from the Medrash that touch on relationships almost at random to give you some insights as to how the Torah sees them. And when I've done the series before, I've spent 7 or 8 weeks on it, so you can bear in mind that we're just scanning it very quickly to give some kind of a sense. And then, unlike the normal Monday night shiur, I am going to leave a bit of time for people to raise issues and questions and examples. Gemara says an interesting thing about an ezer kenegdo. A woman is called an ezer kenegdo, a help against him, or help for him, help opposite him. How does a woman help? What is the nature of her help? The Gemara says, Odom may be chitim. If a man brings wheat home, chitim koses, can he eat wheat for supper? It's got to be ground and it's got to be baked. A lot has to happen before it's edible. Pishton, if he brings linen home, pishton loivesh, can he wear linen? It needs to be spun and it needs to be woven and it needs to be turned into a garment. And then the Gemara adds a really important phrase so that you shouldn't think the woman's function is to be the cooker and the weaver. Nimtzeis, what emerges is, Me'iro einav u'ma'amidoso araglov. She supplies light to his eyes and puts him on his feet. So we're looking at an image, the turning of the wheat into food, the turning of the flax into clothing. Is the role of the women with ideas, with thoughts, with plans, with everything. That he comes with something raw and rough, and she can take it and make it work. She can turn it into something nurturing, something nourishing, something useful, something that can function. And that's the partnership of the Ezer Kenegdo. He can have wild ideas, bring them in, bring them home, and she can deal with it. Now, if men and women were the same, they weren't from Mars and from Venus, then she wouldn't be able to do that. They would both be bringing wheat home and there would be no food. Or they would both be cooking and nobody would bring the wheat. That partnership, the different perspectives, the different value systems, the different way of looking at the world, is what enables her to take some of his thinking and give a dimension to it that makes it real. And then he's able to look at it again and to use it again and to be nourished by it again. But for that she has to be a woman. And for that she has to preserve her femininity. And for that he has to respect her femininity. And enjoy her femininity and celebrate it. Mothers. Mora says, Yehei zohir bitvua betoch beisoy, kedei shelo yovoy lemerivo zelze. He has to make sure that there's money in the house. A husband's role to provide is not only to make sure that there's food in the house, but shelo yovoy lemerivo zelze, but to prevent arguments. There needs to be plenty. So that the husband's role of material provision is not just to make sure that there's enough to eat, but to make sure that she has a sense of plenty to the best of their ability. However they define plenty. Each family has to work its own definitions. But that's important for the relationship. It's not just important for the survival of the family. Somebody has to make a living. Let the husband go out and make a living. It's not just about that. But it's important to her that her husband is somebody who is able to provide material plenty. Piece of Gemara which we've done before in this year. And I'm going to do it again because it's so important and so critical, particularly today. And it's a different, politically totally incorrect. Afal pi sheha isho hi bas zugo shel adam. Starts off saying, even though clearly a woman is a man's equal, they are companions, they are soulmates, they're equal, there's no question about that, and that's how they're intended to be. But that's not how she should see the relationship. Al tachshov be'eneho le'ba'alo kechaver. she should not look in her eyes at her husband as a friend, Elo ke'odoin, but as a master. That doesn't mean as an owner, that doesn't mean as a prince, as a master. V'ha isha te'ahev le'ba'ala v'hu yimshol bo. He needs to feel some measure of mastery over her for her to feel loved. Now, of course, if there's no challenge in the mastery, he doesn't feel mastery. There is no feeling of mastery in mastering somebody that doesn't need to be mastered. So the element of mastery implies challenge. And here you've got this very difficult balance that she's asked to walk between being challenging and yet not, how should I put it, being challenging but not challenging. That she in her essence is a challenging person, that her personality is challenging, that her thinking process is challenging, that in her relationship she makes him feel like a master. And if in her eyes she is like a master, he will adore her and she will be like an equal in his eyes. He will treat her like a sister. Not, that doesn't mean unromantically, that means like a companion, like an equal. It says, Shetzivto chachoma achas levito, a very wise woman instructed her wife, advised her daughter, kishehoisom alicho lebeis baila, when she was leading her to the chuppah. Imagine that, a woman whispering in the ear of her daughter as she's leading her down the aisle to the chuppah. And she said, my daughter, Bisi, imdi lefonov kelifne hamelech v'tishartehu. Stand before him as if you were before a king and serve him. V'imtiye loy amo, and if you will be a maidservant to him, hu ye lecho eved, he will be your slave. V'yechabdech kigaviro, and he will treat you like his mistress. Now we could say this is politically incorrect and this is unfair and this is not equality. Fine, so try it the other way. Ignore the advice if you want to. 50% divorce rate, a lot of singles, that's the outcome. That's the outcome. And when I said women are wise enough to understand men, they understand that. The wise women understand that. Problem. Men aren't stupid, that's not correct. Men aren't totally stupid. They can tell when it's fake. So if she is married to somebody who she doesn't think is great, but she knows she's got to treat him great, otherwise he's going to get all offended and isn't going to relate to her in the right way, it doesn't work. And that means the woman has to be part of this advice, is not just pretend that he's a master. Marry somebody that you can look at as a master. Marry somebody that you can look at as somebody worthwhile, as somebody you want to serve. And service is not something demeaning. Service is something we all willingly do every day, every minute of every day, just about. That's how we earn our livings. You try earning a living without service and see why. We don't feel demeaned because we're serving. We feel elevated, we feel demeaned only if people treat us badly when we serve. But if people treat us well when we serve, we enjoy the service. And when we serve people that we really respect, when we serve people that we really look up to, we certainly don't feel demeaned. So part of this advice is, marry somebody that you can treat as somebody worthy in a real way, so that he can treat you as a mistress, that he can become your slave, because he will be enslaved to a woman who sees him as a master. Again, a master not being in the sense of an owner, a master, the true word of that, the true meaning of that word, in whatever area mastery is important to her. We've discussed that once before. So if she is a musician, she will maybe want him to be a master musician. If she is into the financial things and economics and money and material things, she will want him to be a master at breadwinning. And if she's an intellectual, she will want him to be a master at brilliance. And if she is everything, she will want him to be everything. That just depends on who she is and what that value system is. That he's got to, she's got to be able to look at him as a master in something she values very highly. Otherwise, it's not going to operate. And here we come to the essence of the all. Come to the essence not only of the burden, of the difficulties, of the trials and tribulations of these relationships, but perhaps to the most important reason for the failure of heterosexual relationships. Because heterosexual relationships require two things that are rare today. The first thing that it requires is men who are greater than the women they date. And that's become a problem because, as we started off saying, we're not dealing in a society that focuses on self-improvement. So the women, the men think if they go to gym, she'll look at him like a master. Now, maybe the first time they meet, and maybe in the beginning of their relationship, but she soon wants to get beyond that and see what's there apart from the bodybuilding. What's there apart from the figure? And it starts to crumble. Because we're not living in a society where men go to universities of self-improvement. They go to institutions that teach them how to earn a living, how to make money. The problem is women go to those places too, and they're doing it just as well. There were times when people went to university or people went to yeshivas and they became big human beings. They developed their mind, they developed their interests, they became broader. They became brilliant. They could speak. They were eloquent. They could write. They could read. They could understand. They could hold conversation. They could engage. They could ask questions. They could pose answers on any subject in the world. A woman could look at such a man and say, I can see him as a master. But our whole educational system is so unidimensional, and it's equally available to men and women, and women are excelling at almost anything they're trying, what's left? And the second problem is, we're living in a very democratic society where political correctness rules. And there are not many audiences that I could get away with even reading this Gemara, as you've allowed me to do this evening. It would be rejected, it would just be not acceptable today. Is that right? That's right. So what chance is there of a relationship working if the two elements that are required, men who are worthy of being seen as princes by their wives, and wives who are willing to see their men as princes and not feel demeaned by that, willing to take the risk of believing the Torah and saying, treat him like a king and he will be your slave forever. You want to treat him like a slave, he'll have nothing. You won't have a relationship. That's man and woman. That's this Mars and Venus stuff. That's how it works. That's how God made it. Is it equal? Is it the... Yes, it is equal. It's the finest form of equality. A situation like that where what lands up happening is she's treating him like a king and he's treating her like a queen. He thinks he's the king and she thinks she's the queen. And you know what the truth is? They're both right. She's controlling him and he's controlling her. They're controlling each other with dignity, with love, with care, with affection, with understanding, because they understand that that serving of one another is not demeaning. Elevating the other is the greatest way to be self-elevated. But that's not the ruling philosophy out in the street today. So we find men who go out with women, and the women are out to prove a point that they're as good as the men. Or we have men who go out with women and the women very quickly figure out nothing here to really look up to. It's going to be fake all my life. Not willing to do that. And so that starts crumbling. We have fears of commitment. We have women, men meeting women and not feeling this type of interaction. Being scared of the authenticity of that interaction. We have men seeking the company of men and women seeking the company of women. And they feel safer. Where there isn't this vulnerability, this is enormously vulnerable. And we have relationships breaking down. And I don't want to suggest that it's oversimplified, that just do this and then everything's fine and rosy. All I'm trying to do is, by scanning some of the insightful chazal, insightful statements of the Torah, to try and see an angle that hits home, that despite the socially hostile environment to such values, looking at your faces, I see you saying to yourselves, no, don't want to admit it maybe, but it is true. It actually is true. I'm not seeing people looking around and saying, no, this is way out, this is not right at all. But difficult. Difficult to find, for a couple to find each other who can truly look up to one another in that particular way. And difficult to find a couple who are willing to take the risk of looking up to each other in that way. That occurs, as the Rambam says, the blessing, the happiness, the fulfillment. The Gemara says, a man without a wife, some pretty amazing statements the Gemara has to say about that. Not a man, not alive, that the ultimate of goodness is having that relationship. The Gemara sees just the most amazing beauty and fulfillment and satisfaction in what that relationship is, and what a woman can bring to a man. Even more than a man bring to a woman. A man can bring security to a woman, but what a woman can bring to a man. And yet there's the resistance to commitment. Yet there's the resistance to really say, this is something so vitally important that I can't live without it. Perhaps we'll have to have occasions where we look at this in greater depth and go a lot further than this, look at some of the other elements that play into it, and see the level to which it's feasible to live it in the society in which we operate, and to which the degree to which it's hostile in the society in which we operate. At least let's take home from this, those of us who are in relationships, let's take home some of those values. Those of us who are not yet in relationships, take home some kind of an understanding of the risks one needs to confront, the qualities one needs to seek in the other, in order to build a relationship where one can enslave the other by treating him like a him or her, like a king or queen. Let's spend a few minutes on questions and comments. It's a sensitive subject, a very important subject, an exhilarating subject, and a very painful one. And it would be interesting to share some thoughts on that. The question was, is there something in the fact that many Jewish men seek out non-Jewish women? And again, I don't want to oversimplify a very big and serious problem. And to say the reason is A or the reason is B, and to think that by fixing A or B we'll solve the problem. And yet there clearly are some issues. There is an issue that a lot of the hotbeds of liberal feminism finds its place among Jewish women. And that is what usually drives a lot of Jewish men to Oriental women. The second reason is often that Jewish women are very accomplished, well-educated, high achievers, and they expect more in their men. A lot of the Jewish men can't shape up, and they feel more comfortable with the shop girl or the stewardess who can look at them like a king and doesn't expect that much more. I think there are many reasons. I think there's trying something from another culture, something that's a little foreign. I think all of those reasons and some more, but I think the first two are probably the most important ones. But unfortunately the plague of feminism, and again I want to make very clear what I mean by feminism. Feminism is not women who excel, women who are good, women who are outstanding. That is a woman's right and duty to be the best she can. By feminism I'm talking about women who would say, I will never treat my man like a king. Who does he think he is? Well, that's fine, so don't ever treat your man like a king. See what kind of a marriage you build. It's not what the Jewish man or any man is looking for. And the other reason that the Jewish girls are highly accomplished and have big expectations in whatever value system they're brought up with, whether it's money or whether it's education or whether it's culture or whether it's learning, in whatever area it is, they have great expectations of the men, and the men are struggling to live up to those expectations.
This is a
that that was said, and I know that might still be the case, but I don't know if one should really blame the poor Jewish men who are the victims of these non-Jewish girls who are after them. I think that's part of the patheticness of the modern Jewish man. You know, what could I do? These women were after me, and I think the men have to take some of the responsibility too. A couple of answers to that. Firstly, I wouldn't like to meet the man who would like the woman for whom he's enough. You must hear the men and who they'll look at and who they'll go out with and what kind of quality she's got to have and what she's going to look like and how much money she's got. And not all men, but to say generally that men don't have high expectations of the women they date, I don't know if that's right. I think that men do have high expectations. Yes. Sure. But I think there's a lot in what you're saying. I think one has to develop it. I think there is. I think there's a lot in what you're saying. Let's just take a few more of them. It's an important observation. I think you're saying that careers and professions used to be almost like civilizations that had long traditions and ways of doing things that were and weren't done, and they actually had an impact on the self-development. When we talk about people self-developing in their professions, there was a self-development, a selflessness, a working for the community, making a contribution, that was all an important part of development, and that is no longer there. It's become very much more self-centered and take-oriented rather than give-oriented. And is that part of the decline of the male character? And I'm sure you're right that it is. That the breakdown of the family, the breakdown of religion, and the breakdown of professions as a source of culture have left the man increasingly uncultivated. And that's more of a problem for men than for women, because as you say, women seem to come in almost ready cultivated. The profession is an area of interest for them rather than of cultivation. And could that be one of the reasons that there's a disparity between what the woman expects of the man and what the man is able to deliver today? I think that's very valid. That's an idea. Few men like that. Only one man they have to do like that. And you're right, bearing in mind the fact that women have insisted on doing everything that men do, plus everything they're supposed to do, and for some reason they've glamorized that as being the ideal, that leaves them with little emotional space to actually create that king out of someone. They're battered out there in the marketplace too, and to make someone into a king requires emotional energy too. And women, as they need to function today, often don't have that emotional energy. Some women find the opposite. If they're in a work environment that stimulates them, if they're in a work environment that somehow nourishes their mind and their interests so that they don't come home drained, they come home self-satisfied and able to give, that's then a more positive environment. But most women aren't in that situation. Thank you once again. We thought that the last year was the end of the winter series, but I guess that was the end of the Book of Shmuel, and this will be the end of the winter series, and we'll recommence again sometime during the month of March.
There's downside, but there's no upside. There's no limit to the upside. It's totally unlimited. Because it's Migrome, this is a fountainhead, this is somebody or a group of people who are developing and producing their own. And that's life. And when less lay Migrome Klum, when we've got nothing, we need to find things to distract ourselves. We need escapism. We need to be distracted. That's when we need time to pass, when we're not using our creative force. And our creative force isn't just inventing something new. Creative forces in the way we do anything. Anything and everything we do can be a container of water, a pit of water, or it can be a fountainhead. It can have the stamp of our own originality, of our own style to it, of our own way of looking at the world, of our own understanding, or it can just be replicated mass production. And the more we're into the cookie cutter process, the more we desperately need distraction. The because that's not living, that's not life. David loses Avisha. One man, and he realizes, my goodness, we don't count people. Because one man can be worth 75,000 and another man can be worth nothing. You can't count people. You count their capacity. So if I was counting, we should have counted as Avishai as 75,000, not as one. And he realizes, I've done a terrible thing. I've counted people. God says, you're right. And now choose the punishment. I've got to teach you what you lose by seeing people that way. And he loses Avishai. Again, God's justice, there must have been other reasons for Avishai to die. It's not justice. God doesn't just take people for that reason. But the timing is such. God does it at that timing so as to create the lesson. David says, forgive me, this is serious. Don't let any more people die. God says, then bring a sacrifice. Now comes the test. Out comes Arvana and says, David, a sacrifice. Help yourself. If David would have said, thank you, Arvana, the book of Samuel wouldn't have ended. We would have had another plague. And another plague. David says, Arvana, I'm trying to stop plague. I'm trying to stop death. I'm trying to bring back life. Life is contributing. Life is paying your way. Life is investing. Life isn't buying. Life is not about gifts. I cannot accept your gift, Arvana. I must pay for this. I must purchase it from you. And that way God's anger will be removed from the earth. And so it is. To say what the book of Samuel has been about, I'm sure each of you would answer that in a different way, those of you who have been through the whole book with us in the last 2 years or so. I'm sure each of you would have a different perspective on what the book was really about. Was it about the kings, about Saul, David? Was it about the battle with the Philistines? Was it about the passions of a man such as David, contrasted with the correctness of a man such as Saul, such as Shaul, different kings, different styles? Or was it perhaps about the founder of the house of David, the founder of the dynasty that will ultimately produce the Mashiach, forging a way for himself that is always original, not always 100% right, but always original, always his own man, always trying to find that balance between operating within the authenticity of what he's allowed to do, because he learned from Shaul what happens when you step outside of that authenticity. Being original does not mean you become unauthentic. Unfortunately, there's a very fine line between being original and being fake. Very strange that there should be. But fake is faking originality, isn't that so? If there wasn't originality, there would be no point in faking. And we very easily, in our desperate attempt to be original or to be seen original, copy and plagiarize and imitate. And David realizes there's a need to be authentic. But authenticity means a simultaneous faithfulness to God and his Torah and myself and my soul. And is this not the story of a man who, in setting the foundation for the house, the royal house, that would produce the Messianic period, finds his place, learns his lessons, explores and experiments until he finds that place, where he's able to find the authenticity of true life, giving, contributing, investing, creating, and as king, making that the environment in which his people operate and live, understanding the value of people, understanding that people are not to be counted, and that life is not about quantity. That life is about the difference we make, the contribution we make, the value that we are. Thank you for sticking with it, for staying with it. Many started this year and dropped out after one. Others dropped out after two or three. Some dropped out after 10 or 11. Most of the people that drop out after two or three. Some came sporadically. Some it's been difficult to come regularly, and they've come as regularly as they can. But most of you have been with it for a long time, studying harsh material that has nothing to recommend it other than that it's true. It hasn't been entertaining at all times. It hasn't been light. It hasn't been comforting. It's been challenging. It's been stretching. But it's been real. And I like to think that that's what differentiates you from so many of the people who are not here. Not people who don't know about it or haven't tried it, but people who it's just not for them. Is that you seem to be people who are willing to come to put time aside in an evening, on a working evening. It's not an easy thing to do, to come on a Monday night, come regularly and continuously. Study Torah, to hear Torah, be willing to hear it from a different angle. Those of you who have studied the book of Samuel before, I would guess, haven't studied it in exactly the same way before. Those of you who know the stories might have heard the stories in somewhat of a different way. And you've been able, open to examining it, understanding it, grappling with it in a way that has often been discomforting, but has always been real. It's been a pleasure and a privilege for me to share these times with you and to see the extent to which you've been able to sit with it, focus, concentrate. Now in the beginning when we started out, and say sometimes you don't see the development, but I do. In the beginning when we started, people couldn't concentrate for more than 10 or 15 minutes. And they were up getting drinks, and they were sitting down, and they were coming in late, and they were wandering around, and they were shifting, and they were falling asleep. And maybe I've just improved my presentation. But I don't think so. I think that you've grappled with the subject matter and grown and developed and stretched your souls and your capacities in a most magnificent way. And I hope that when we reconvene, we'll decide what we'll study next and how we'll study it. If you want to give any input in the meantime, I'll be happy to hear what you would like to study. Don't guarantee that that's what we'll study. I like to enjoy it too. But whatever we'll do, I'm sure, will be fascinating, continue to be intriguing, continue to be challenging. Thank you for your participation, for your contribution, and for your being here. Good evening.